A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about light bulbs again, but not the way you'd expect. Not color temperature, not smart home integration, not whether the fixture should have a thread radio in it. He's looking at the whole arc of lighting as an energy story, and his framing is that we've lived through one of the only unqualified wins in electrical engineering and barely noticed it happening. The tungsten filament that dominated for a century is now a museum piece. The halogen that was the premium option in my memory is dead in new builds. And the LED that was a dim, expensive indicator light when I was young now runs entire cities for what used to be a rounding error on the electric bill. His three questions: have we actually hit the ceiling on efficiency, or is there still headroom? What's the genuine cutting edge, the stuff being deployed right now that isn't a lab curiosity? And are the old filament bulbs truly obsolete, or just waiting out their last decade in a basement somewhere? So, how did we get from a wire that glows to a semiconductor that thinks it's a flame?
Start with the scale of what happened, because it's the part that doesn't get said enough. Lighting used to be about 15% of global electricity consumption. 15% of everything we generated went into making photons by heating metal until it was hot enough to glow, and that fraction has fallen below 10% in about a decade. That's a demand-side reduction on the order of taking hundreds of coal plants offline, and it didn't require building a single new power station to replace them. We just stopped wasting the electricity we already had.
The demand-side win is the rare kind of infrastructure victory that doesn't get a ribbon-cutting ceremony.
Nobody photographs a coal plant that didn't get built. But that's the story here. Lighting got so efficient that it became invisible. The cost of running a bulb dropped from something you thought about to something you don't. My parents' generation walked through the house turning off lights because a 100-watt bulb left on all day was real money. Now a 10-watt LED left on all year costs less than a cup of coffee.
And the timeline is the part that should make everyone pause. Edison's carbon filament is from 1879. Tungsten replaced it around 1910. Halogen showed up in the late 50s. Fluorescent was there the whole time, but it was always the ugly compromise. And then the blue LED happened in the early 90s, and the deployment happened in the 2010s. A century to perfect the wrong approach, a decade to replace it with the right one.
The Nobel Prize in Physics went to Nakamura, Akasaki, and Amano in 2014 for that blue LED. And it's worth dwelling on why that was the bottleneck, because it's the part most people never hear. Red and green LEDs existed since the 1960s. They were in your calculator, your VCR clock, your stereo indicator. But you can't make white light from red and green alone. You need blue. And blue required gallium nitride, which is a material that for decades refused to be made into a usable crystal. The lattice doesn't want to grow cleanly. The doping was a nightmare, and the Japanese academic establishment had largely given up on it.
Nakamura was at Nichia, a small chemical company, not a university lab. He built his own reactor because the commercial ones weren't good enough.
And he published the breakthrough in 1993, a blue LED bright enough to actually use. That's the moment the whole thing turns, because once you have a blue LED, you can make white light two ways. The cheap way is what almost every bulb you buy uses, a blue LED shining through a yellow phosphor, cerium-doped Y egg, and the blue plus the yellow reads as white to your eye. It's a compromise. The spectrum isn't full. That's why early LEDs had that cold, flat, slightly wrong look. The color rendering index was bad because there were gaps in the spectrum.
So the white light we've all been living under for a decade is a trick. A blue photon hits a phosphor. The phosphor re-emits a broad yellow glow, and your eye averages the two into something it accepts as white.
And the averaging is the key word. Your eye is doing the averaging. The object you're looking at might not be reflecting the spectrum it had under sunlight. Red things looked dull, skin tones looked off. The newer high CRI LEDs use multiple phosphors, sometimes a red phosphor added to fill in the gap, and that's why a premium bulb today looks dramatically better than a cheap one from 2015.
But the efficiency story is what Daniel asked about, so let's put numbers on it. The tungsten filament, what's the actual luminous efficacy?
About 15 lumens per watt for a standard household bulb. And the physics of it's brutal. A tungsten filament runs at about 2700 Kelvin, and at that temperature, something like 95% of the energy it emits is infrared. Heat, not light. You're running a space heater that happens to glow a little. Halogen gets you to maybe 20 lumens per watt by running the filament hotter and recycling the evaporated tungsten, but it's still fundamentally the same technology. You're heating metal until it glows.
95% waste. That's the number that should have been on every bulb package for a century.
And then the LED arrives. The early white LEDs in the mid-2000s were doing maybe 30 to 50 lumens per watt, not obviously better than fluorescent, but the curve was moving. The cost per lumen was dropping by a factor of 10 per decade, and the output was rising by a factor of 20. It's the semiconductor learning curve applied to light. Every 2 years, roughly, the efficiency doubled. That's the finding from the Nature Energy paper by Sao and his collaborators, and it's still going. Commodity LEDs today are doing 100 to 150 lumens per watt. Premium ones are over 200.
And the theoretical limit for a perfect monochromatic green light at 555 nanometers is 683 lumens per watt. That's the ceiling physics allows for the most efficient possible light, the wavelength your eye is most sensitive to.
But nobody wants to live under monochromatic green. To make white light with acceptable color rendering, you're paying a penalty. The phosphor conversion loses energy. The spread of wavelengths means you're emitting some light your eye doesn't use as efficiently. The practical ceiling for a usable white LED is generally cited in the 250 to 370 lumens per watt range. So a premium LED at 200 is maybe 60 to 80% of the way to the practical limit. There's headroom, but is not another order of magnitude. The easy wins are gone.
So the answer to Daniel's first question, have we peaked, is no. But the character of the gains has changed. The chip itself is approaching its physical limits. The remaining wins are in the system around the chip.
And that's the part that doesn't get covered because it's less glamorous. Emitter efficacy is what the spec sheet brags about. System efficacy is what actually matters in a building. The driver that converts AC to DC loses 5 to 10%. The optics that shape the light lose another chunk. Thermal derating means the chip runs hotter inside a sealed fixture and loses efficacy. And then there's the control layer, occupancy sensors, daylight harvesting, dimming. A light that's off when nobody's in the room is infinitely efficient.
The frontier has moved from making photons more cheaply to not making photons you don't need.
And that's where the deployed cutting edge actually is. The filament LED, the retro-looking thing with the little zigzag of light-emitting diodes arranged to look like a tungsten wire, isn't nostalgia. It solves a real optical problem. A classic LED bulb is a flat disk of emitters on a heatsink. The light comes from a surface, not a point. That's fine for a table lamp with a shade, but it's wrong for a chandelier with exposed bulbs, or a fixture with a reflector designed around a point source. The filament LED recreates the point source, so all the old optics work again. It's a technical fix that happens to look charming.
I'd been dismissing those as pure retro kitsch. The Edison bulb aesthetic that every coffee shop installed in 2016.
The coffee shops were chasing the aesthetic, but the underlying engineering reason the form factor survived is that optics care about geometry. A reflector designed for a point source doesn't work with a diffuse disk. The filament LED is the compatibility layer between 100 years of fixture design and the new light source.
And the smart lighting layer is the other thing being deployed in new builds now, though not the way the consumer market framed it. Not the screw-in bulb with the radio in it, which we've covered before and which is mostly a retrofit kludge. The new construction version is the fixture itself being the device. Tunable color temperature, occupancy sensing, daylight response, all integrated into the luminaire and tied into the building's control system.
The thing that's quietly emerging is Li-Fi, using the LED's ability to modulate at frequencies the eye can't see to carry data. It's not replacing Wi-Fi, but there are deployments in places where radio is problematic, hospitals, aircraft cabins, secure facilities. The light is doing double duty. That's the real frontier, not more lumens per watt, but lumens that are doing more than one job.
Let me pull on the grid implication, because this is where the story gets strange. Lighting's share of global electricity fell from about 15% to under 10% in a decade. That's the aggregate effect of a billion small decisions to replace a bulb, and it happened without anyone coordinating it. No treaty, no grand infrastructure project. Just the price of LEDs collapsing to the point where the economics made the decision for everyone.
The regulatory arc helped. The EU banned incandescent bulbs in 2012. The US followed with standards in 2020. But by the time the bans landed, the market had largely already moved. A 60-watt incandescent replaced by a 9-watt LED pays for itself in months. The ban wasn't forcing people off something they wanted, it was closing the door on something that was already economically indefensible. The halogen phase-out followed, and the fluorescent phase-out is happening now, partly driven by the Minamata Convention on Mercury, because fluorescent tubes contain mercury vapor, and the world has decided it doesn't want mercury in its lighting anymore.
The fluorescent tube, which was the efficiency champion of the 1980s, is now the thing being phased out as hazardous waste. The efficient technology of my childhood is the environmental problem of today.
That's the pattern. Every lighting technology becomes obsolete the moment something better clears the bar. The tungsten bulb is already dead in new construction. The halogen is dead. The CFL, the compact fluorescent that was the awkward transitional technology of the 2000s, is dead. The linear fluorescent tube is dying. The only question is how long the installed base lingers. And the answer is, longer than you'd think. There are basements and garages and utility closets with tungsten bulbs that will be running for another decade because the bulb costs a dollar and the fixture was installed in 1980 and nobody goes in there often enough to care.
The last tungsten bulb will probably be in a string of Christmas lights in someone's attic, and it'll outlive all of us.
The other knock-on effect that deserves more attention is what LED efficiency did for off-grid lighting. A solar lantern with an LED and a small battery can replace a kerosene lamp for a family in a village with no grid connection. Kerosene lighting is expensive, it's dangerous, it fills the house with smoke, and it's terrible light. The LED solar lantern changed that. The efficiency of the LED is what made it possible, because a solar panel and battery small enough to be affordable could suddenly produce useful light. That's a quality of life improvement that doesn't show up in the grid statistics because there was no grid to begin with.
The architecture point. Light got so cheap that it stopped being a utility expense and became a design material. Buildings now use light the way they used to use paint. Facades, accent lighting, color washes, all of it running on a fraction of what it'd have cost 20 years ago. The Empire State Building's lighting bill is a rounding error compared to what it was.
Which brings us to the rebound effect, and this is the part where the energy story gets honest. Jevons paradox, named for the 19th century economist who noticed that making coal use more efficient led to more coal being burned, not less, because the efficiency made coal-powered processes cheaper and therefore more widespread. The same thing applies to light. When light gets 10 times cheaper, people buy more of it. They leave lights on. They install more fixtures. They light their gardens at night, their driveways, their stairwells. The rebound effect eats some of the efficiency gain.
But not all of it, and not even most of it. The net effect is still massively positive. Lighting's share of electricity fell by a third to a half, even with the rebound. The rebound is real, but it's a partial offset, not a cancellation.
The rebound has its own ceiling. There's only so much light a human being wants. You can't light your house 10 times brighter than you did before, indefinitely. At some point, it's just unpleasant. The rebound effect is strongest in the transition from scarcity to abundance, and then it saturates. We're probably near the saturation point in the developed world. The developing world is still on the upward slope.
Where does the efficiency curve go from here? The chip is approaching the practical white light ceiling. The remaining gains are in the system. What's actually in the lab that might change the picture?
A few things. Laser excited phosphor is one. Instead of an LED chip, you use a blue laser diode to excite the phosphor. Lasers can run at much higher power density without the efficiency droop that LEDs suffer at high current. That's the problem where an LED's efficiency falls off as you push more current through it. Laser phosphor systems are already in some automotive headlights, the BMW laser lights, and they're being explored for projection and specialty lighting. Micro-LED is another. Arrays of tiny individual emitters that can be addressed separately, which is more about displays and adaptive lighting than general illumination. quantum dot down conversion, where instead of a phosphor, you use semiconductor nanocrystals that can be tuned to emit very specific wavelengths, which could buy both color rendering and efficiency at once.
The narrow band red phosphor is the one I find most interesting. The reason high CRI LEDs lose efficiency is that the phosphor mix has to emit a broad spectrum to fill in the gaps, and broad emission means energy spent on wavelengths your eye doesn't use well. A narrow band red emitter gives you the red you need for good color rendering without wasting energy on the deep red your eye barely sees.
That's the trick. Color rendering and efficiency have been in tension since the first white LED. The technologies that break that tension are the ones that matter. Perovskite emitters are the wild card, cheap solution. Processed materials that have been improving fast in the lab, but stability is still the problem. OLED lost on efficacy. It's fundamentally a broad emitter and it's better at being a display than a light source. The honest summary is that the chip level gains are getting harder, and the system level gains are where the action is.
If I'm a builder in 2026, what am I putting in a new building?
Integrated LED fixtures with tunable white, tied to occupancy and daylight sensors. No screw-in bulbs in the main lighting. The fixture is the device. The control layer is networked, probably Matter or a building protocol like Dolly or KNX in commercial. The driver is high efficiency, the optics are designed for the specific LED array, and the whole thing is rated for 50,000 hours or more, which is the point where the fixture outlives the building's renovation cycle.
The screw-in bulb survives in retrofit and specialty. The lamp in the corner, the fixture someone doesn't want to replace, the dimmer that's too old to work with LEDs properly.
The Edison socket is a 130-year-old standard. It's the most successful electrical connector in history, and it's now mostly a compatibility shim. The future doesn't need it, but the past is full of it, and retrofit is a huge market.
Before we wrap, there's a man in the room who's been staring at that filament LED with a strange look on his face.
You're both right, but that's not what I came out to say. I want to know whether these new lights would let me run a grow lamp in a windowless bathroom off a single solar panel and a car battery without the battery catching fire.
I have questions.
I ran the lighting board at a regional theater in the late 80s. Night shift electrician. The dimmers were resistance dimmers, which is a polite way of saying giant rheostats that dump the excess power as heat. The control room hit 40 degrees Celsius on summer nights. The smell was hot ceramic and dust. I lost 8 pounds one summer just sweating into the board. The old lights weren't just inefficient, they were a thermal management problem. Every watt that didn't become light became heat somewhere, and in a theater, the somewhere was usually the room I was standing in. The stage manager kept a graveyard of dead tungsten bulbs in a milk crate. He swore the old 2-kilowatt spotlights had a signature warm-up glow that LEDs couldn't replicate. The way the filament came up to temperature, the color shifting from deep orange to white over a second or two, he called it the lamp's breath. I kind of agree with him, and I know it's nostalgia for inefficiency, but there was something about light as a heavy thing. You could feel a 2-kilowatt spotlight on your skin from 20 feet. The light had weight. The LED doesn't have weight. It's better. And I don't want to go back, but the old light was something you were in, not something you were under.
The physics of that's real, actually. The tungsten filament is a blackbody radiator, so its spectrum shifts as it heats up. The warm-up is a journey through color temperatures. An LED just switches on at whatever color temperature it was designed for. The transition is instantaneous.
The heat. A 2-kilowatt tungsten lamp is putting out nearly 2 kilowatts of heat. An LED putting out the same amount of light is putting out maybe 200 watts of heat. The radiant heat on your skin is a real sensory difference, not just nostalgia.
The stage manager would have called it the soul of the lamp. I'd call it the waste heat, but I'd still notice it was gone. The solar panel and the car battery. Would it work?
A modern LED grow lamp pulling 50 watts off a 100-watt solar panel and a car battery with a charge controller is entirely doable. The efficiency is what makes it possible. 20 years ago, you'd have needed 10 times the panel.
Good to know.
The thing I keep coming back to is what happens when light becomes effectively free. If the efficiency curve keeps going, even slowly, and the system level gains keep compounding, the marginal cost of a lumen approaches zero. And then the question stops being how much light you can afford and becomes how much light you actually want.
The rebound effect has its own answer to that, which is that we already bought most of the light we wanted. The developing world is still catching up, but the curve flattens. The next frontier isn't the bulb, it's the system. Lighting in 2036 won't be a replaceable part. It'll be a layer of the building, integrated with power, data, sensing, all of it running on a fraction of the energy we used to spend.
The tungsten bulb's obsolescence isn't a loss. It's the sign of a technology that did its job so well we stopped noticing it.
That's the rare thing. An electrical engineering success story that actually succeeded, that didn't just move the problem somewhere else, that made the world measurably better and then got boring. The best technologies get boring. That's how you know they won.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, for keeping the board running.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.